begins thusly. April 25th, 1973, between 9 and 10 p.m., Henry McDaniel hears a scratching sound at the front door. He peeks out and thinks maybe it's a bear. With a gun and flashlight in hand, he proceeds to go outside. A strong wind is blowing. He sees something between two of his rose bushes, something he fires four shots at, as it startles him so badly. It hisses like a wild cat when one bullet finds its mark. It flees towards a railway embankment not far away and covers 50 to 80 feet in three jumps. With, I might add, its three legs. Two arms, short little arms, short body, and big pink eyes. Grayish in color, it stood only 4.5 feet tall, at most. It was almost human, the body. There was another encounter, though, 30 minutes prior, and it goes like this. 10-year-old Greg Garrett is in his backyard stargazing. Now and then he tries to catch a firefly, as we children often did. As he did, he encountered a monster. It was 4 to 5 feet tall. It had slimy gray flesh, red eyes, glowing red eyes, tiny arms, razor claws, and three legs. One of those legs touches the boy's sneakered foot, tearing the shoe. Greg flees in terror to his house. Even after bursting through the door and telling his parents, they didn't know what to think. Could it be his imagination? Regardless, they call the police because he's so upset. And they do arrive, and they do search the area, but they find nothing. Perhaps the creature ran to Henry McDaniel's home. And the reason it scratched at the door was it, too, wanted to hide. Before Henry went out to check, it said that his children were already relaying frightening tales of something trying to get inside the house, either through the window-mounted air conditioner area and also the front door. That's when Henry heard the scratching, even as his children told him their story. They described a beast to him, the beast he ended up shooting at. Though he didn't think it was real at first, and he didn't put two and two together before he went outside. Children are excitable after all, and they see all manner of things that don't exist. Or do they exist? Some tales do say it hopped 75 feet after he fired. 75 in three hops. Henry, too, called the police, by the way. He said, "I had an encounter with a monster from outer space." Illinois state troopers arrived on the scene. They searched. They discovered footprints, like a dog's, but with six toe pads, and that's two more than canines have. The trail suggested three-legged creature. There were indeed scratch marks on the house. But what could the troopers do? A week or two passes. Things are quiet. Until maybe around 3 a.m., the McDaniel family has another incident. Henry awakes to frantic barking, his neighbor's dogs. He grabs his gun and makes for the front door. He steps out and sees the same creature farther away than the last time. It's messing about on the railroad trestles near his home. Quote, "I saw something moving out on the railroad track, and there it stood. I didn't shoot at it or anything. It started down the railroad track. It wasn't in a hurry or anything." McDaniel called into the radio station WWKI to tell his story. That's where the quotes come from. A search party formed, which included news director of WWKI, Rick Rainbow. They explored, in daylight, and reported seeing an ape-like creature standing in an abandoned building near the McDaniels' home. There was said to be recordings of its cries. They fired a shot. It fled. Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist, investigated this case and the recordings. Henry McDaniel is interviewed two days later on air. Press reports police were called to investigate gunshots. They arrested five young men. They were out-of-towners. See, stories had spread, as they are wont to do, and those young men wanted a picture of the Enfield monster. White County Sheriff dismissed their claims, saying it was, quote, drinking and raising hell they were doing, not shooting at monsters. Reporters and scientists eventually come to Enfield, too. It was a tantalizing tale, after all. And the population of Enfield temporarily increased. Allegedly, the sheriff threatened to arrest Henry McDaniel if he kept telling his story. Whatever the case, screams and shrieks were heard by many people in town in the nights following. And then, as quickly as it arrived, the beast vanished. Lauren Coleman, our cryptozoologist, wrote in Fate magazine article called Swamp Slobs Invade Illinois about his findings. The creatures were so far beyond our understanding that it's no wonder stories about them excite incredulity. He relayed an account of a sighting in the Murfreesboro region, approximately 70-ish miles from Enfield, June 25th, after midnight. While parking in a boat ramp near Big Muddy River, Randy Needham and Judy Johnson hear a terrifying shriek. Quote, about three times as loud as a bobcat, only deeper. They then saw a creature rushing towards them. But this was 7 feet tall, white of hair, and was within 20 feet of them before they got the car started and fled straight to the police station to report it. Two officers investigated. They found large, erratic footprints. No two were the same distance apart. The next night, Merrill Lindsay, one of the officers, went for a camera to photograph the prints. Jimmy Nash, the other officer, went with Randy and Judy to follow the prints. Another shriek was heard. The beast was 100 yards from them in the wooded area. They did the human and very smart thing. Go back! And they did go back. Away, that is. The next night after, around 10 or after 10, a 4-year-old named Christian Beryl told his parents he'd seen a big white ghost in the yard. Now, they took this as imagination and they really didn't fret too much about it. They didn't think much more about it. Until 10:30, they find that neighbors Randy Creeth and Cheryl Ray were sitting on the back porch when they spied something in the trees. Cheryl said she saw glowing pink eyes, but it was also the tall, white whatever. Police did find footprints and smashed vegetation. This time, Nash, with Officer Ronald Manwarren, followed the trail with Jerry Nellis and his dog. It was a German Shepherd, and it did start to track something. Nash noticed slime here and there. When he touched it, it left black on his fingers. And also, the dog hesitated a bit before passing each trace of slime. They ended up at a pond. Nothing there. They went south of it. There was an empty barn. They sent in the dog, which ran right back out. But they found nothing. There were other sightings over the next few weeks by carnival workers, a woman who heard a scream, that sort of thing. One other odd sighting was October 16 in St. Joseph, a small town 161 miles north of Enfield and 220 miles slightly northwest of Murfreesboro. Four teens were driving along and thought they saw a campfire near the bridge, so they stopped to have a look. One used a match as a light once he got out of the car. Not far away from them was a 5-foot-tall, gorilla-like creature. They immediately sped off. Now, these look nothing like the Enfield monster, but what the heck is going on in Illinois? I tell you, I can find more stories. Are they connected? Is it mass hysteria brought on by creepy tales and it spread across the consciousness of the population? Is it even real? And what do people in Enfield really see? In 1978, there was an investigation into the Enfield monster. Only three witnesses are on record then who claim to have seen it, though at the time there were many more claims. Even those three said that their stories had been blown out of proportion. The one solid tidbit is two neighbors giving the same description of said monsters before each knowing the other had seen it. There have been no further sightings since that original story. Now, are there theories? Well, of course there are. One of them, which I find kind of hilarious, is an escaped kangaroo. The tail could appear to be a third leg, if you've ever seen the way a kangaroo sometimes sits. And I suppose it could seem that way in the dark, sure. But McDaniel says, no way. And in fact, he had owned one as a pet when in the military service in Australia. Mate. An Ohio man apparently wondered, though, after he saw media coverage, if it was his lost pet, Rue Macy. What are you doing with all these kangaroos in the States, man? Okay, one was in Australia, but what are you doing with a kangaroo in the States in 1973? Why do you have this as a pet, sir? I guess that's a story for another time. Now, the people who investigated in 1978 were from Western Illinois University. David L. Miller was the lead investigator. They published the findings as a case study in social contagion. Quote, in this area of Southern Illinois, it is not unreasonable to assume Mr. M or the radio news team had actually seen an animal. People were interviewed, framed the recent events in these terms. Their accounts admitted the possibility that large dogs, calves, bears, deer, wildcats had been sighted. Some frames suggest that an exotic pet, such as an ape or kangaroo, was the catalyst for monster reports. Finally, some people tactfully suggested that Mr. M had a notoriously overactive imagination and had probably been shooting at shadows. In any event, we interviewed only one person who agreed with Mr. M's claim that he had indeed seen a monster from outer space. All right, listeners. That is a summary of the Enfield monster. I will, of course, put links in the show notes because I have a website that shows a picture of McDaniel and his screen door with some big old rips in it that is allegedly taken from that time. Okay? And if that's what it was, I mean, it is kind of creepy. And then there's a webpage that tells you a whole lot about all of these other sightings that don't look anything like his creature, but goes into this other creature. Because I think they're two separate things if they exist. And there's a lot of other stuff that I think goes on in Illinois, as I recall. So these are not the only things. We could probably keep going. What's your impression about this? What's your impression? I am looking now at some actual newspaper clippings as well. And one of the stories that I relayed to you was called The Coal Street Monster Story Keeps Being Told. This might be a little too small for me to read, but this was by Jill Peterson and Paula Castros in the Tazewell News, November 3rd, oh, I can't tell, 1990 perhaps. Something lives deep in the thick woods which Coal Street cuts through. Sure, there's rabbits, deer, raccoons, but legend has it that something else is there too. Not many have actually seen it, but those who have say it's big, hairy, and has a foul odor, and it's not something they want to see again. The Coal Street Monster. The legend of the Coal Street Monster can be traced back many years, all the way to the late 1930s. Many people think the monster could somehow be associated with the old coal mines in the woods of Coal Street. Coal Street was named for the numerous coal mines once operated in the area. Mining companies worked the area in the mid-30s, and most mines were abandoned by the end of that decade. Then, rumors about the monster began to circulate. The monster apparently kept to itself for the most part until the 1970s, when numerous sightings were reported. Bill Beard, 38, of 1600 Bloomington Road, was born and raised in Coal Hollow, which is the section of Coal Street at the bottom of the hill. He recalled an incident when he was 16 which happened to his mother. Ah, and guess what? It cuts off there. Oh, don't you hate me now? Actually, I can tell you a little bit more. Someone did state that the creature was between 8 to 9 feet tall, had white hair all over its body with human-like hands. They also noted that a putrid smell appeared to accompany its presence, and once it had left, they discovered strange foot tracks that indicated it had 3 toes. But following that last sighting, reports of the strange beast died down almost as suddenly as they began. So they're just like hit and runs, aren't they? However, just shy of 20 years after that incident, 1991, Peoria Journal Star received a sudden phone call from Randy Emmert. He would claim that he had essentially made the whole thing up. And while this might, for some, allow the incident to be dismissed as nothing but a hoax, the fact is that many other people at least claimed to have seen the strange creature. Whatever the strange creature might have been, and whether it had connections to other similar sudden sightings of strange beasts, is open to debate, and something we will turn our attention to shortly. Do you want to hear some more incidents that may or may not be related? These are also reminding me, if any of you out there watched Hellier, especially season 2, and it just ends up getting into all kinds of deep cave conspiracies, and they start out with Mothman, gets into Indrid Cold, which I personally find that one creepy. For some reason, and it ends up with cave systems. I'm probably going to remember this wrong off the top of my head. Kentucky? And for sure, though, I'm pretty sure they go through Illinois. And they're just, you end up with like all kinds of stories. Little ape things, UFOs, Indrid Cold, you know, whatever. So if you haven't checked that out, it might still be on Amazon Prime. It was pretty interesting. So in 1977, Dover, Massachusetts, there was a brief encounter with a very strange creature known as the Dover Demon. Over 2 different evenings, a total of 4 different people witnessed a strange, white, gray-skinned creature with glowing red eyes. After the 48-hour period, it seemingly vanished into thin air and was never seen again. In Victorian England, in and around London, a bizarre entity that was referred to as Spring-Heeled Jack, and I should probably do a podcast on that, terrorized the community for years before seemingly disappearing into the nothingness of time. I'm quoting that from this website. It's UFOinsight.com. And there are marked differences in appearance between Spring-Heeled Jack and this creature. The leaping ability of Spring-Heeled Jack is what is interesting and has similarities to the Enfield Monster, for example. Over 3 decades before the incidents that took hold of Enfield in spring of 1973, in 1941 and 1942, there were several sightings of a similar creature to the Enfield Monster in and around Mount Vernon, which is approximately 40 miles from Enfield. According to a report that appeared March 1946 in an edition of Hoosier Folklore, in the summer of 1941, a local priest was squirrel hunting. Blah, blah. You knew I had to happen eventually. Yes, he was. He was squirrel hunting and made his way through the woods near the creek looking for his next catch. And I wanted to say crick because I'm from the Ozarks. And as he was doing so, however, a large animal, similar in appearance to a baboon, appeared from the woodland. As the strange creature moved towards him, the witness struck at the beast with his gun barrel, quote, and it was temporarily stunned, but it wasn't until he fired several shots in the air that the beast made a quick getaway. But on following evenings, the strange beast seemingly made its presence known. Many residents in the area claimed to hear terrorizing screams coming from the woodland around the creeks. Furthermore, there were also several sightings of the creature in the woods, as well as strange tracks being discovered. The sightings and strange sounds would continue for several months and stretched into the spring of 1942. So regular were the incidents, the reports of them, that most of the townsfolk were ready to hunt it down for themselves, especially after a local farmer claimed the monstrous creature had killed his dog. Yeah, that's fighting words right there. That's, you don't kill my dog. But they didn't manage to track down or capture any creatures. It appeared to have made its way away from the area at the same time as the hunting began, as if it knew. And according to the report, there were sightings in other areas of woods around 40 to 50 miles away of a similar-looking creature over the next days and weeks. Some witnesses claimed the creature jumped through the air, covering around 20 to 40 feet per leap, similar to the Enfield creature. And as you can guess by the name Spring-Heeled Jack, he can leap, or could. Now we come to a section, the Devil's Kitchen, with the long history of bizarre happenings. The American Midwest, and perhaps specifically the Southern Illinois region, has had more than its fair share of strange things. The region in and around Southern Illinois has a long history of bizarre and unnerving incidents, so much so that the Native Americans that have resided in the region for hundreds of years call it the Devil's Kitchen and ultimately believed the land to be cursed, so this says. Many accounts speak of beastly-like entities that roam in the dense woods of the region, while others speak of strange orbs of light dancing in the sky and above and around the trees. There are also tales of ghost-like figures, similar to shadow people, which lurk around the area. More alarming are accounts of people hearing deathly screams and unsettling cries coming from the region in the middle of the night. Now, whether you subscribe to the notion of curses and what they might be or represent or not, the fact is, all of these locations are home to a plethora of strange goings-on, ranging from lights to monstrous beasts. Now, considering these things, might we seek a connection, which I asked you before, are they connected? They had mentioned earlier about the campfire that the kids had pulled over, right? The teens had pulled over to see October 1973. They are pondering here on this webpage whether or not it was a portal or gateway. And it sounds outlandish, even to paranormal researchers and enthusiasts. There have been documented cases of apparent portals appearing in the middle of nowhere and of strange creatures emerging from them. So they say. In fact, now they want to tell us about an incident that unfolded during the NIDS investigation into Skinwalker Ranch. Have you heard of it? That's pretty infamous. In the mid-1990s. During a night in August 1997, while monitoring the ranch for strange activity, two NIDS members, quote, Jim and Mike, pseudonyms, witnessed a strange yellow-orange light suddenly appear in the distance. What's more, it appeared to be growing in size right before their eyes. While Jim would make attempts to photograph the light, Mike began to view it through his binoculars. And by this time, the light was approximately a foot across. Furthermore, it continued to grow. As he watched in amazement, he announced to Jim that it's not a tunnel, not just a light. Then he claimed that there was something in the tunnel. He said it was a black creature climbing out. I see his head. It has no face. It just climbed out. He went on, saying that the creature, whatever it was, dropped onto the ground and then simply walked away from the tunnel, which then began to decrease in size until it disappeared altogether. And I'm here to tell you, dear listener, that that sounds like something out of the Dean Koontz novel. Oh, I forgot the name of it. Is it called Winter Moon? I've got it around here somewhere. A guy in a cabin, and there's a portal that keeps opening in the woods. It doesn't end well. You guys know that one? I'm not saying they're making it up. I'm just saying. And when is this, in the 90s? I'm not sure when that book was written. Maybe Koontz got the idea from them. It's possible. I'm not sure the date of it. Pretty sure it's called Winter Moon. Somebody check that out for me. Yeah, okay, thanks. Now, Lauren Coleman, back to our cryptozoologists, had some other observations. The creatures reported are almost always bipedal, hairy, and subhominid in general appearance. Their color is variously as white, gray, or brown. The eyes are usually pink or red and glow in the dark. He also noted the speed that they could move, as well as their ability to leap enormous distance, seemingly from a standing or sitting position. And each of the creatures also appeared to make horrendous shrieking sounds, and it is most often witnessed, of course, when you're alone, or when it is alone. Some things that don't add up, though. I give them credit here. They're letting us know some things that don't add up here on UFOinsight.com. There's a difference in height of the beasts. Some are 4 to 5 feet. Others are 9 feet. Discrepancies with the number of legs. Enfield monster very clearly reported with 3 legs. And then there are the differences in the toes or paw impressions from report to report. Coleman notes that the strange creatures occasionally appear in the company of the other uninvited visitor, the UFO. While many researchers have highlighted comparisons between UFO hotspots and increased Bigfoot sightings for years, they finally used the word Bigfoot, it appears that UFO appearances also accompany sightings of many other strange entities. Might it be that the same speculative portal that the creatures at Skinwalker Ranch emerged from also gives transit to these otherworldly vehicles? Who's writing this? You guys' page, I like you. It's pretty cool. So, they also asked the same question I'm asking. Is this just a standalone case with the Enfield monster? Or do they actually fit into some larger story, some larger puzzle piece? Do we even know? It's pretty creepy. You know, I can't imagine looking out and seeing... I can't imagine looking out and being like, oh my God, there's this three-legged thing eating my roses or whatever the hell it was doing. Could you imagine? Now, I want to give you a little definition of what Coleman meant by social contagion, okay? This involves behavior, emotions, or conditions spreading spontaneously through a group or network. The phenomena has been discussed by social scientists since the late 19th century, although much work on the subject was based on unclear or even contradictory conceptions of what social contagion is. Some scholars include the unplanned spread of ideas through a population as social contagion, though others prefer to class that as memetics, which I suppose is another thing I'm going to have to click on in a minute. Generally, social contagion is understood to be separate from the collective behavior which results from a direct attempt to exert social influence. I'm going to say like dictators or something is what they mean by that. Two broad divisions of social contagion are behavioral contagion and emotional contagion. The study of social contagion has intensified in the 21st century. Intensified. Okay. Much recent work involves academics from social psychology, sociology, and network science investigating online social networks. I knew that was coming. I'm just reading from a Wikipedia page for a definition for you. Studies in the 20th century typically focused on negative effects such as violent mob behavior, whereas those of the 21st century, while sometimes looking at harmful effects, have often focused on relatively neutral contagion, such as the influence on shopping choices, and even positive effects like the tendency for people to take an action on, say, climate change once a sufficient number of their neighbors do. Oh, yeah, I mean, come on. Do you really need a broad study for that? All you got to do is... Okay, well, here's one that maybe is not so scientific, but I'm telling you, if you've ever waited tables, you know what I'm about to say is true. You send almost everyone else home except for one or two waitresses. I'd usually be the one left. Because, hey, it's all died down. It's quiet now. And then all of a sudden you get a rush. Because it's like we have this shared hive mind and we all show up at the same place at the same time having the same idea. And it's not just because people normally have lunch at a certain time or this or that or the other. Hit me up if you've ever noticed that with other things. Or you go over to look at a booth at a festival and nobody's there, but then you get there and all of a sudden everybody's there. Why? Maybe they saw you. But it's that sort of thing, right? We're like little sheep. And don't pretend you're not. It happens to everybody. I know I'm not going to get political, but some of you out there might be cringing. I'm not a sheep. No, we can all be sheep. Sorry. It happens. You know? Nobody really wants to be first for a lot of things, right? But once somebody else does it, it's like, oh, that seems like a good idea. You know what I'm talking about. I don't need a scientific study for this. So when you start having people talking about seeing things, that starts to rub off on other people. And especially if you're kind of into it in the first place, it's very easy to have that confirmation bias, shall we say, and it's not an insult because we all do it with different things. We all gravitate towards things that agree with us or that fit something in our minds. That's human nature, and that's why sometimes we can be manipulated that way. And again, I'm not going to get political, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, okay, enough of that. I feel like, yes, I had another newspaper clipping, which probably won't tell me the whole thing either, allthat'sinteresting.com. Three legs, pink eyes, as big as flashlights. A Monster at Enfield, by Dennis Montgomery, Associated Press writer. So it was reported at the time, just like I told you. Enfield, Henry McDaniel says he shot and wounded a monster on his doorstep and is worried it may come back to get even. McDaniel, 50, said he had just returned from a meeting Wednesday night when he heard something scratching on his door. It had three legs on it, he said. A short body, two little short arms, and two pink eyes as big as flashlights. It stood 4.5 to 5 feet tall and was grayish colored. It was trying to get into the house, he said. McDaniel, an antique dealer, said he slammed the door and grabbed a pistol and a flashlight from the dresser in his bedroom and returned to the front door, opened it, and spotting the monster about 12 feet from the house, he fired 4 shots. When I fired that first shot, I know I hit it, he said. The creature gave out a hiss, much like a wildcat's, judging from his imitation of the sound. Now, it gets kind of cut off here because they just have a scan of it, but... Covering 50 feet in 3 jumps, it fled through some bush along a railroad embankment that runs near the McDaniels' home. State police, summoned by the frightened McDaniel, arrived too late to spot the creature but discovered its tracks in the soft earth about the home. McDaniel said the track was like a dog's except that it had 6 toe pads. One of the troopers, James Masser, said McDaniel appeared rational and sober. And I think I might have said poor James Masser's name wrong a little while ago because I couldn't read my own dang writing. Sorry about that, James. We have now corrected it. McDaniel said he was sure it wasn't a dog and was positive it wasn't a kangaroo because he said he once had a pet kangaroo, as I told you, while serving in the army in Australia. When he was asked how he was able to note so many details of the creature in such a short space of time and in the dark, McDaniel said, "I have a photostatic memory." And then he recalled that the creature's body was almost like a human's body. He said some school children told him they had seen a similar creature at the school ballpark. If they do find it, they will find more than one, and they won't be from this planet, I can tell you that, he said. Enfield is about 10 miles west of Carmi, White County, in southeastern Illinois. That is the actual news clipping. I believe I already told you that, yes, they did see scratches on the door screen as well as footprints. It did make it into the Reading Eagle. I think that is the clipping I just read, but it is said that most people did not believe that any of it is true. Now, there is a claim that a 10-year-old neighbor faked his account, that he actually admitted later it was a prank against the McDaniels. But I'm not sure about that, because I think, to be fair to Henry McDaniel, I think that this article here has confused that hoax with the other one that I mentioned, a different one, because that 10-year-old boy, I forgot his name. You can rewind and find it. I'm not going to rustle all the papers. That 10-year-old boy was 30 minutes apart from the McDaniels. They saw it 30 minutes before Henry McDaniel did. And there's no way. Like how was that to trick McDaniel when the police had gone out to the boy's house first? And then Henry sees it. The only way it's an actual hoax is if the kid had said, "I dressed up in the suit and went there," or "I ran to their house and made the noises." Because the accounts that I saw, the 10-year-old witnessed it first. 30 minutes later, you know, McDaniels have the same creature going on. I'm not sure how, I don't think they were close enough to get to each other in 30 minutes. And the police went to both places and found footprints. So how can that be to tease McDaniel when they didn't even know about it yet? You know what I'm saying? I think that somebody mixed this up somewhere, because I read more than one account where the 10-year-old saw it first and nobody else mentioned that he had faked it. I maybe if I Googled some more, but this is the only one that said that. I think they confused it with the other faker. Anyway, there's still no explanation for it. We'll end on that. There's no explanation for the Enfield monster. That one segued into a few different sort of cryptid things, a little disjointed perhaps. So I am going to tell you, I'm going to read you just a couple of things to fill out this hour. I'm almost having a Art Bell Coast to Coast episode here. Creepy stories of people literally being saved by the bell. It's commonly used to describe people who escape difficult situations thanks to a last-minute solution. But the lighthearted phrase actually may have a true scary story behind it related to a medical condition known as catalepsy. I think I already know this one. Yep, I know this one. Catalepsy is a medical condition in which a patient endures an uncontrolled state of muscle rigidity and unresponsiveness. The condition is often linked to episodes of catatonia, and you've heard the word catatonic. Although the disease is widely understood now, in the past it caused sufferers to be mistakenly buried alive. Yeah, I knew where the phrase "saved by the bell" came from. Maybe you did too. But it's always an interesting story. After newspapers reported on these tragic endings, writers like Edgar Allan Poe built similar incidences into his creepy stories. The frequency of catalepsy patients being mistaken for dead people led to a string of quick-fix solutions by doctors and gravekeepers, though many of these ideas created new horrors of their own. One well-intentioned yet morbid solution was the creation of waiting mortuaries. In these hospitals for the dead, the bodies of suddenly catatonic patients were kept under observation for a few days to make sure they were actually dead. Waiting mortuaries were well stocked with food, wine, and cigars in the event that a patient woke up. Is that gruesome? I mean, I think that's just logical. Yeah, why you guys think, who's this author? Why do you think that's gruesome? You're just, it's like a wake. You're waiting to see if they wake up, but that's not gross. It's practical. But they go on to say another more gruesome solution to avoid burying those who were still alive was to perform examinations to test the deadness, quotes, of the patient. People thought to be dead had the, that's gross. People thought to be dead had their fingers hacked off. Could you imagine them waking up later and looking down? Ah! Where's my fingers? Yeah, okay, author, that is gruesome. Or endured, and this is where that phrase comes from, I believe, smoke literally being blown up their ass. The assumption was that if the person didn't wake up, then they were unequivocally dead. No, really, it's true. You're blowing smoke up my ass. Otherwise, the procedure was used to revive those who were on the edge of death via tobacco's supposed restorative properties. So you had a smoke enema. A smoke suppository. Do we want to know who had to do the blowing? Oh, okay, maybe I hope they used a tube, a funnel, a bellows. Oh my God. Now I'm imagining somebody being puffed up like a puffer fish. Okay, sorry. All right, there was only one problem with such a test. Catalepsy prevents patients from feeling pain during their catatonic state. So, you know, like chopping off somebody's fingers wasn't going to do shit to wake them up. There are true scary stories of being buried alive that also spawned the creation of safety coffins. 18th and 19th century Europe, especially Victorian England, enough people were being mistakenly buried alive that coffin makers came up with several solutions. These caskets were designed with above-ground horns or bells that a person who found themselves mistakenly buried alive could ring from the inside when they woke up trapped underground. Some of these safety coffins came equipped also with a stash of poison in case the person figured out that they just weren't going to be safe. Too bad. Because really, if no one's around to hear the bell ringing, you're probably going to suffocate. Other models used glass panes that would fog up if the person was still breathing. Question. Why didn't you just hold a mirror or glass to the people's noses or mouths in the first place before you buried them? Okay. Now, some coffins had tubes that gravekeepers would have to sniff each day. Okay, it's funny, but it's not funny. To confirm that the body inside was actually decomposing. Other people were simply buried with the keys to their own coffin in their pocket. But, you know, you're just going to have to dig through that dirt. Sorry, too bad, so sad. Maybe you should give them a spade. But the bell models were the most pervasive. The morbid contraptions are allegedly where the phrase "saved by the bell" comes from. It's unclear whether safety coffins did any good to reduce the number of people who were accidentally buried alive, but the thought of being trapped with no escape for eternity is enough to send chills down your spine. All right, did you like that one? Okay, we'll do one more. The unexplained number stations, which maybe this will kind of tie back into our creepy creatures and UFOs and things. At the height of the Cold War, when radio was still a top medium for disseminating news and information, many listeners accidentally stumbled into some rather unnerving programming. These creepy broadcasts would typically begin with a strange melody or several beeps and were followed by the voice of a woman or a child reciting seemingly random numbers. I just got the worst spinal monkey, y'all, and the hair on the back of my head is starting to stand up. What the? I swear, now see, this is why I say Indrid Cold is creepy. I was going to do an episode on him, but then like when I was researching some stuff, I got totally creeped out, and I usually don't have that happen, so maybe I should stop reading. If you don't hear from me after this, send help. Ring the bell. Okay. So the discovery of these strange numbers stations quickly gained attention among those who were unfortunate enough to find themselves listening to these mysterious broadcasts. The phenomena also spawned a fringe group of radio listeners dedicated to solving the mystery of who was sending these broadcasts and why. Each number station they discovered was given a name depending on the nature of the broadcast. Among the most well-known were the Nancy Adam, Susan, the Gong Station, and the Lincolnshire Poacher. They were all uniquely bizarre in their own way, spurring a number of creepy stories about who could possibly be behind them. It wasn't until the 1980s that amateur sleuths tracking these number stations hypothesized that the mysterious broadcasts were actually coded messages used in espionage operations across the globe. The idea has been supported by figures like Rupert Allison, an author who specializes in espionage and writes under the pen name Nigel West. Nobody has found a more convenient and expedient way of communicating with an agent, Allison said. Their sole purpose is for intelligence agencies to communicate with their agents in denied areas, a territory where it is difficult to use a consensual form of communications. Remarkably, these short waves of alleged coded messages can still be found on the radio today, so long as one is diligent enough to search for them. Espionage tactics may seem like the most plausible explanation for these ghostly signals, but the true intent of some of these number stations have never been cracked. One such station, known as the Buzzard, has been sending out mysterious broadcasts since the Cold War. It features two buzzes at the top of every hour, followed by a monotonous drone between every 21st and 34th minute during daylight hours. A voice follows, reading a string of numbers, words, or names in Russian, like Anna, Nikolai, Ivan, Tatiana, Roman. It was initially believed that the broadcast was set up by Soviet authorities, but after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the strange radio broadcast only became more active. To this day, nobody knows who started it, what it's about, or why it continues. The true scary story of the number stations goes on. Have you guys ever heard of that? Okay, I think we're going to end there. That's really weird. I wonder if I've ever heard of those accidents. I mean, you know, we had radio all the time when I was young. I mean, heck, I'm 55. I'm trying to remember if we ever came across, you know, weird white noise type of, probably just didn't stop to listen to it though, because it's like, no, I'm looking for Duran Duran. You can always find me on Twitter to tell me if you've ever had that experience or heard it, or if you went out and tried it now. I would suggest probably AM radio. You know, it didn't say, but that would be my guess. That would be my where I would first start if I was going to do it. You can find me at PodPinky. You can email me sroyt, R-O-I-T, at pinkyswearpress.com. Like, if you have any cool ghost stories, UFO sightings, you know, cryptids like Bigfoot, this, that, and the other, stuff that you would like to tell me about, and I can share it, maybe just on its own bonus episodes, that would be super cool. Or just say hi and let me know if you like what I'm doing. If you don't like it, well, you can just be quiet. You don't have to be mean. You can find my official website, pinkyswearpress.com, where I talk about my books, and I have blogs and photographs and podcast links and merchandise links. You know, I do still have merchandise. I do, if anyone is interested. Go to pinkyswearpress.com and try out my new book, Dark Wings. It's supernatural, I would say. male-male romance, urban fantasy type thing. And I'm working on some other stuff, and for my Paris Immortal fans, and I noticed somebody is picking those up again, so hopefully new fans, you're reading the old version because I am getting closer to being finished typing out the omnibus, although, Loki knows how long it's going to take me to proofread several hundred pages, but I'm getting there. So there will be an updated, all-in-one-volume Paris Immortal series. Should be this year. I'm going to be vague because I'm not sure. I get very arthritic in my hands. This is not a sympathy grab. It's just a fact. One, it goes up in my shoulder. I just have a hard time sitting here typing thousands of words, okay? It's 350-some thousand words so far. You know, what are you going to do? So, yeah. I guess that's it. Oh, and find me on Instagram, peaky_podcast. I'll post some creepy pictures. You got any creepy cryptids in your area? Or a story you think that I would just think is really cool and that I should look up? I should look up Spring-Heeled Jack. There's actually a fictional book that I read that they wrote around Spring-Heeled Jack. Totally steampunk. And I've totally forgotten the author. Damn it. They were with my original publisher. You might check it out. It was kind of cool. All right. Thanks for listening. And, you know, beware of three-legged... No, I won't say it. Okay. Boop, 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 bow.